we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
We are sensible defenders of humanity and freedom and non-racism and non-oppression. Those puke in there are fascist evil scum. They want to hurt us, they want to crush us, they want to hurt black people, Asian people, Muslim people, white people, gay, straight, anybody. There isn't a fascist piece of puke.
Tommy, it's good to see you. I'm very sad for what you've been through, but I'm thrilled that you've been emancipated. I feel like you've been freed in so many ways.
Yeah, I'm so happy that I'm happy for me. I feel weird, man, because I am happy, but I don't feel happy. I can't express. I don't feel super happy. It's strange.
You were abused. I don't want to be condescending, but I think what they did to you was a form of physical and psychological abuse.
Yeah. So I haven't had a conversation with anyone for 2.5 months. I haven't seen anyone. So other than 1 hour. Twice, where I saw my wife and children.
For 1 hour only?
Yeah.
And when I saw murderers get more time than that.
How comfortable are you in supporting Tommy Robinson, given the kind of things that he's said about Muslims?
What's he said about Muslims?
Well, for example, after the 9/11 attack, he says, every single Muslim watching this, on 7/7 you got away with killing and maiming British citizens. You had better understand that we have built a network from one end of the country to the other end, and the Islamic community will feel the full force of the English Defence League if we see any of our British citizens killed, maimed or hurt on British soil ever again.
Sorry, I'm not sure what's contentious there.
Well, Muslim women should not be a useful political battleground for old Etonians. This has happened before. It is crass and it must stop and it must be condemned by the leadership right from the Prime Minister down.
The beast of the far right has awoken across the West in various guises. Brexit, Trump, societal backlash against refugees, migrants and immigration. We have been witness to a carnival of reaction in conditions of economic recession, dislocation and austerity. However, if there is one minority community that has been on the receiving end of this backlash more than any other, it is the Muslim community. Focusing in on this malign dynamic in the UK specifically, when the country's former Foreign Secretary and putative Prime Minister Boris Johnson feels emboldened to publicly slander the burqa worn by a section of women, Muslim women in the UK, we have entered a sinister period. When Tommy Robinson supporters are provided with mainstream media platforms on the BBC and they're allowed to spew their toxic politics uncontested, we have entered a sinister period. And when Robinson himself is released from prison on bail, having been sentenced to 13 months for contempt of court, and finds himself widely hailed as a working class hero, a champion of free speech and quote-unquote British values, rather than the anti-Muslim bigot he is, it is time for all people of conscience and consciousness to wake up to the far-right beast that has arrived in their midst. What needs to be understood when it comes to the far right is that it is incapable of rising to a position of prominence on its own. Its politics are far too narrow, exclusionary and sectarian for it to do so in a multicultural society such as Britain's. What it needs in order to rise is the tacit, if not implicit, connivance of an establishment in crisis. This in periods when capitalism is in crisis. This was a situation when Oswald Mosley and his British Union of Fascists rose to prominence in Britain in the 1930s. And it's the situation we find ourselves in today, with Tommy Robinson being feted as the man of the hour by his growing band of supporters and a mainstream media whose denizens have taken to referring to him by first name only, Tommy. Indeed, what we now have is a situation where Jeremy Corbyn and the politics of hope and class transformation have been placed on the cross by the political and media establishment in the UK, while Tommy Robinson and the politics of hate and sectarianism have been placed on the stage. In the 1930s, the same political and media establishment, fearing a rising tide of support for communist and socialist ideas, on the part of a working class that was mired in unemployment, poverty and comatant despair lent its weight behind Mosley and his fascist black shirts. The most infamous example of this support was the 1934 Hooray for the Black Shirts headline that was carried on the front page of the country's mass circulation Daily Mail newspaper. Even so, out of that dark period comes hope. For even though Mosley and his fascist army of thugs received the sanction of a section of the British establishment, they were ultimately defeated by a working class when it mobilised and organised as a class for itself, rejecting the attempt to divide it on racial, religious, and cultural grounds as the left of the day rose to the challenge. Thus, in October of 1936 in the East End of London, thousands of men and women, Jewish, Irish, English, people of all faiths and none, turned out to meet the attempt by Mosley to march through their community with over 2,000 of his men in lockstep. In their wonderful diversity, the working class of the East End of London chased them off the streets in an event known to history as the Battle of Cable Street. So yes, the British left and working class rose to the challenge of the far right back then. The question now is, can it, will it, rise to the challenge again? I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Issa Ali is a writer and broadcaster whose expertise on this subject is unsurpassed. Issa, welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Let's just, if we can, track the trajectory of this, because I do think there is a linkage as part of our process, which began with the 6 years of Tory austerity from 2010 to 2016, producing justifiable anger in large swathes of the country on the part of a working class that was left battered and bruised as a result. This anger gave us Brexit in a campaign whose politics was dominated by far-right and right-wing anti-migrant hostility and xenophobia. And Brexit, when it came to pass, unleashed a carnival of reaction, which normalised xenophobia, normalised anti-migrant hostility and normalised the othering and demonisation of minorities, in particular the Muslim community. Then in May of this year, Tommy Robinson was arrested and sent to prison after trying to live stream an ongoing trial involving sexual abuse of minors. He pled guilty to the charge of contempt in court and was sentenced to 13 months. This produced a wave of Free Tommy Robinson marches and rallies in London specifically. They were very violent. And at these rallies, we had the common sight of fascist salutes being thrown by Tommy Robinson's supporters. Tommy Robinson was released after only 3 months on bail due to a technicality. And upon his release, he has, as I said in my introduction, been feted as the man of the hour, a working class hero. Nothing like the man whose politics, when he was a leader of the EDL in 2011, were cited by the mass murdering white supremacist Anders Breivik in Norway as an influence in his own political thinking and worldview. And now we have the former Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson and putative Prime Minister feeling emboldened to publicly slander the dress of Muslim women in the UK. There has to be a connection here, doesn't there?
I think as well, John, if you, I mean, you rightly go back to 2010 and the election of the coalition government, but I think we can go back even further and let's say go back around 20 years. You had in America, the project of for the new American century, which were pushing a long held desire for them to basically promote invasions and wars in the Middle East for a variety of reasons, for the protection of the Zionist entity Israel, for the for oil reasons, for geopolitical reasons, geostrategic reasons. Part of that, which was attached to it, was the need to demonize and put Muslims in a negative light in order to justify those invasions, to depict them as a barbaric, savage people. And after 9/11, that really kicked into gear. You saw, of course, with the 9/11 attacks, many unanswered questions, but one of the outcomes of it was a rise in anti-Muslim hate. And from there, which is where I started to notice it, is was a kind of industry, a very niche cottage industry online of hate sites, people like Pamela Geller, people like Daniel Pipes, all of these people spewing out Robert Spencer, spewing out anti-Muslim and anti-Islamic rhetoric. Now, at that time, it was quite a niche. It was a dark corner of the internet, which unless you were like searching it out, it didn't really have much sway. But we fast forward, as you said, you have 2009, I think it was, you had a couple of Salafi Wahhabi extremists who protested the US UK soldiers in I can't remember the exact place it was, Wuttenbassa, I believe it was.
Wuttenbassa, yes, correct. Yep.
Yeah, and that's what sparked Tommy Robinson to start his EDL. And then from there, the year later, we had the election of the coalition government and austerity, and everything kicked in. So this is something which has been stirring in the pot, but it's only been in the last perhaps few years where it's really started to move into the mainstream. I think Brexit was a big catalyst for it, possibly. You had the kind of rhetoric from people like Nigel Farage around immigration, which moved the conversation in that direction. But since then as well, you've had within the Tory party a move to the right, almost to try to hoover up and attract UKIP voters. You've had UKIP themselves going through a number of leadership changes. The most recent one is Gerard Batten, who is perhaps the most right-wing and extreme leader they've had. He's trying to hoover up those to the right of him, the so-called, you could say the Four Britain Party.
Isa Batten recently described Islam as a death cult.
He's somebody who's trying to like hoover up to the right of him. So what you're having is actually, and as you said in your intro, it's not so much that these people or these parties will become mainstream. It's that the mainstream parties, well, the right-wing mainstream parties, let's say the Tories and the UKIP, if you could describe them as mainstream, they're trying to hoover up those votes by adopting this kind of language. And I think it's very telling that someone like Batten feels he can get away with that, to the point where, from what I understand, even Nigel Farage is said to be quite uncomfortable with the direction that Batten's taking UKIP. Batten attended a lot of those Tommy Robinson rallies, so-called free speech rallies. Ironically, counter-protesters being attacked at those. So, so much for free speech.
Also, police officers were attacked.
Police officers. They were, look, I mean, the things these people have been getting away with, and, we don't want to advocate any kind of state crackdown on free speech, especially genuine free speech. But, I mean, you had people climbing on the gates of Downing Street. Anyone else had tried that, you could be sure that they wouldn't just be allowed to do it. And yet there's been this kind of...
Yeah, these people promote themselves as British patriots, and there they are trying to climb over Downing Street and attacking British police officers. Isa, we've come up to the break. That was a wonderful contextualised history of this. You're listening to Isa Ali. This is Hard Facts. We'll be right back. Hard Facts.
We have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard Facts.
Welcome back to the second half of Hard Facts with me, John White. I'm sitting down with writer and broadcaster Isa Ali, and we are discussing the rising tide of far-right politics across the West, but specifically in the UK upon the release of Tommy Robinson and upon former Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson's outrageous remarks slandering the dress of Muslim women. Now, Isa, self-styled champion of the working class, Tommy Robinson has just been released to wide acclaim, not only within the UK, but internationally, from where we know he has received money and support from people such as Steve Bannon and even Donald Trump. Now, Isa, that history that you laid out was wonderfully helpful, because the reality is that our extremism begat the extremism of Salafi jihadism. When I say our extremism, I'm talking about the extremism of Bush and Blair with their messianic desire to reshape the Middle East in their own image, posited as a war for security and to promote democracy and women's rights in the region. But as we know, as anti-imperialists, it was a war for oil. It was a war for strategic advantage. It was a war of opportunity. It ended in the disaster that the anti-war movement knew it would and predicted it would and proclaimed that it would. And then we've had the intolerable situation where we've had the eruption of Salafi jihadism across the region, with the Arab Spring on the back of the global economic crash of 2008 to 2011 and onwards as the casus belli, and that resulted in other wars, the NATO intervention in Libya. The point I'm trying to make, Issa, is that the clock did not start on 9/11 when it came to this unending chaos and conflict emanating from the Middle East. Then the unconscionable stance when it comes to the Israel-Palestinian conflict, where the Palestinians are, to all intents, depicted as children of a lesser God. They have to take responsibility for this, don't they?
It's more than even just blowback. Our extremism created their extremism, if that's how to put it. But also, our extremism utilised and used our extremism. As you mentioned there, you talk about Libya. I mean, look, the Manchester bomber, Salman Abedi, he was part of a fighting group of Libyans from Manchester who went out there to overthrow Gaddafi, who were helped by the British directly. Not, you know, this isn't some indirect, oh, we didn't know what they were doing. This guy was saved, rescued by the British Navy and evacuated from Libya when things got too tough. He then came back to the UK and murdered 22 young children and their parents at a pop concert. So then we have to go further than, it's more than just blowback. I mean, blowback gives the idea that, oh, well, you know, we didn't know what was going to happen. They've been using Salafi jihadists in their so-called jihadists, should I say, in their fights since Afghanistan with the Mujahideen, since Chechnya, to undermine the Russians, in Libya, in Syria. You know, there's this constant...
Yugoslavia.
There's this constant link between the NATO countries and Saudi Arabia and the Salafi jihadis, which always comes back and bites the working class, normal people in the bum in the terms of, you know, terrorist attacks. What's key is that those working class people see the bigger picture and don't just lash out and say, oh, well, the Muslim community need to do more, when actually the Muslims around the world are probably the biggest victims of these terrorists. I've been to Iraq, I've been to Syria, I've been to Lebanon. There are Muslims going and fighting and ending up in their graves because they're fighting these crazy, psychotic people. And actually, you know, I was in Lebanon and I met a few people who were injured fighting to liberate one of the Christian towns in Syria. And I interviewed them. And so, you know, you're looking at people who are fighting to protect minority communities in the Middle East who are Muslim themselves. So I think people need to zoom out, look at the bigger picture and not be led by this very easy kind of rhetoric used by people like Tommy Robinson. Yeah, very reductionist. Oh, Muslims. And the thing with people like Tommy Robinson is, you know, he talks all of this. And at the end of it all, he'll go and he'll whitewash and push out Hasbro propaganda for Israel. Israel just recently evacuated the White Helmets, who have got longstanding links with militant groups in Syria. They've been on record helping al-Nusra-linked groups in the south of Syria. And, you know, so you look at all of this, you look at the whole big picture, and then you ask yourself, how sincere is this man for really, really dealing with these problems? And on the issue that Tommy Robinson seems to be pushing his Islamophobic agenda of grooming gangs, there's another guy called Stinson Hunter, I believe his name is. He's called the Paedophile Hunter. He's been tweeting against Tommy Robinson recently because he says, look, I do exposés of everyone. I don't care if they're Christian, if they're Muslim, if they're all religions or none. If they're involved in inappropriate or criminal behavior with regards to children, I will expose it. Tommy Robinson doesn't do that. He specifically seeks out certain people who should be in prison, by the way, who should be prosecuted to the fullest of the law. And he wants to build a narrative of Islamophobia or anti-Muslim hatred around that. The other thing is, as repeated judges have pointed out to him, his actions are actually almost sabotaging these trials and resulting in a case where some of these guys are going to get off because of his behavior. And he doesn't care because it makes him, oh, I went to prison, I'm the martyr, I'm the hero. So any listeners who are listening to this show and listen to Tommy Robinson and are following him, I just say zoom out, look at the bigger picture and understand that what this man is doing is actually not just counterproductive, but dangerous in the long term. And I don't know where it's going to end. I don't know where he wants it to end.
Well, that's a very pertinent question. Now, you made a number of very, very salient points, and I'd like to unpack some of them, because the point about the fact that Muslims are the biggest victims of this menace, this extremism, the Salafi jihadi sectarian menace, I've described it as a latter-day Khmer Rouge, is key to the entire question of which we are exploring now. Because as we speak, Russian soldiers and airmen are fighting alongside the Muslim-majority Syrian Arab Army, Iranian Muslims, also the Muslims of the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah. They are doing all the fighting against this menace on the front lines, and it's Muslims who have been the biggest victims of it, because ultimately, in the last analysis, the only divide that really matters is not that between Muslim and non-Muslim, Christian and non-Christian, religious or non-religious. It is between sectarian and non-sectarian forces. And the West has traditionally been on the side, as you rightly point out, of sectarian forces in the form of this Salafi, jihadi, sectarian literalists. The fountainhead of this ideology is, of course, Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. We have, when I say we, I mean the West, have enjoyed a strategic relationship with this sectarian ideology going right back to the end of the First World War, and you catalogue the specific instances in which this relationship was in sway. Where does this end, you ask? Do you think we have a left that's up to the task?
I think, just on a very quick point, just to pick up before that, you say about sectarianism in the Middle East, it's, you know, you have a UK government propped up by one of the most vicious sectarian parties in Ireland at the moment. So their history with sectarianism is it's at home and abroad.
Yes,
as well.
Collusion in Ireland, absolutely. Yep.
I think with the left, I think the issue that we have now is you have a leader in the Labour Party who is probably and he's not even that far left. I mean, there's a ridiculous idea that Jeremy Corbyn is somehow this radical leftist. He actually offers a very tame centre-left social democratic platform, and even he's being hounded by other by the mainstream media and by other people in his party. And I feel like a lot hinges on how the Labour Party, where how they this battle wins out, because I think what Corbyn represents is a battering ram to mainstream politics, and he's kind of like a battering ram which opens the doors for others to come through and open the ground on the left. And I think there are springs of hope, but I think as well you still have this kind of confusing centrist liberal position, which people confuse with being left wing, which have actually allowed this kind of right wing rhetoric to grow. And I think this is the problem. You've had mainstream articles. Oh, well, let's just hear what Tommy Robinson has to say among mainstream and central centrist outlets or so-called self-described centrists. And so I think what the left needs to do is firstly get their house in order. I think they need to win the battle of ideas amongst themselves. And I think as well, on the streets, we just don't see the mobilization by the left that you do. And I'm not talking about violent mobilization. I'm talking about counter-protest. I'm talking about winning the so-called culture war, the media war. At the moment, it looks like the right are much better organized. They're better funded. You've seen in the last few weeks, John.
They're certainly winning the battle of ideas. There's no doubt
about
it.
They're winning the battle of ideas, but there are people behind them. You know, at the beginning of my first answer, I talked about Daniel Pipes. He's been funding Tommy Robinson with his Middle East Forum. Him and a whole network of really dodgy pro-Israel, far-right, anti-Islamic groups have been funding Tommy Robinson and his movement. So you have to wonder, all this money is coming from somewhere. They're receiving funding, they're receiving training. So the left needs to understand, firstly, the machine that's against them of very wealthy interests, and also the battle that's going on. As you said, it's a battle of ideas, and they need to figure out how to win that without ceding any ground. I think sometimes we've seen even Corbyn himself try to kind of play to certain nativist narratives.
Yes.
And it doesn't work. So I think the left really need to win that battle of ideas first before they even think of anything else.
And on the depiction of the Muslim community as one homogenous, monolithic bloc, that must be insulting for you, is it not?
Yeah, it is. I mean, look, there's a saying, if you put two Jews in a room, you get three opinions. I think if you put two Muslims in a room, you get about 30 opinions. I think Muslims are very diverse in thought, very diverse in understanding. I think one thing which is frustrating as well is even amongst myself, I look at certain segments of the Muslim community. I look at the role Saudi Arabia plays on Western Muslims in particular. It's really strange, John. Like you go to a place like Morocco and or Lebanon or Syria, all these countries where, I hate to use the term, but it's just normal moderate Islam. And I don't like to use the term moderate because it's, you know, it's so loaded, but it is. And then you come to the West and there's so much kind of Western, so much Saudi influence amongst Muslim communities. And outsiders don't see that there's a huge debate within Muslim communities about everything from the Middle East, from politics, from religious practice, from culture. And so when you look and you say, oh well, you know, you all get painted the same way, it's you want people to take a step back and look at it and say, actually, firstly, this conversation needs nuance. And again, like, we go back, it's Muslims around the world, in the Middle East in particular, not just Shias, not just Sunnis, but cross-sectarian forces who are challenging this crazy ideology. And so then you do all of that and people turn around and say, oh well, you know, Islam this and Muslims that. By and this is another really important point, John, just to also make it. We have a problem with Salafi extremists literally interpreting the Quran. We also have the same problem of Islamophobic bigots doing the exact same thing, where they say, oh, well, this verse says kill these people, so that's what it must mean. So the irony is you have these Islamophobes and these Salafi jihadists.
Two sides of the same coin.
Interpreting the Quran. Yeah. Exactly. Two sides of the same coin, interpreting the Quran in the exact same way, and then telling everyone else that they're not real Muslims.
And this country's support, mainstream support for the Wahhabist underpinned state of Saudi Arabia and the Zionist state of Israel, both are sectarian states, and both of those states are key in the West strategic relationships. And at a time of extremism, that is a key relationship, whereas, as you rightly said earlier, the price for it has been paid by the working class in various ways.
Exactly.
How do we tackle this unconscionable and ongoing bias towards Israel when it comes to Israel's apartheid, ethnic cleansing and brutal oppression of the Palestinian people? Do you see BDS having a role to play in all this?
I think BDS has a massive role to play. I think, look, Palestine will be free, it will be through resistance. There is no other path, but BDS plays a role. You know, these things aren't mutually exclusive. I think everyone in the West with a conscience, everyone who in the West, especially those of the generation above mine who grew up in the era of apartheid, and you know, you saw the cricket boycotts and so on, which had such an effect in South Africa. They have to understand that Israel is a very similar state, if not the exact protocopy. The only difference is, rather than black and white, the difference is Jewish and Arab. And so people need to understand that this is a moral issue.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu, sorry to interrupt, Archbishop Desmond Tutu said it was worse. Israel was worse than what they went through.
Well, far worse. It's far worse. And at the end of the day, you know, that's one thing people have to do, BDS. The other thing is that this, what we're seeing right now with the Labour Party and this kind of constructed anti-Semitism row, it's got nothing to do with anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism, according to even the research carried out by Jewish groups, is more prevalent on the right than it is on the left. This is about defending Israel and silencing all opposition to Israel and to its characterization as an explicitly genocidal apartheid state. If there's anyone who wishes to join the Labour Party and fight this fight from within, I think that's a huge battle going on. How that battle pans out between within that party, within the right of people to be able to criticise Israel in the strongest terms possible, is how this conversation will go. But fundamentally, I think people need to... There's also, unfortunately, amongst the working class, this idea that Israel is somehow an ally of the United Kingdom. People need to remember, Israeli terrorist groups killed a number of British soldiers at the King David Hotel. They were waging an entire campaign against the Brits. So this idea that somehow, you know, these are natural allies is frankly, firstly, inaccurate. It's ridiculous. And secondly, it's not in Britain's interest, not in Britain's real interest, to be so allied with Israel and with Saudi Arabia as well. But unfortunately, we have in this country an establishment, a military, political, financial media establishment, which are not just beholden to those interests, Saudi and Israeli interests, but themselves are invested in them. And it's kind of a mutual thing. British geostrategic interests represented by having puppets in Saudi and Israel.
Thank you, Issa, for your wonderful insight and knowledge on this issue. What we do know is that those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And by God, we need right now to learn from our own history when it comes to the rise of the far right and fascism. You've been listening to Issa Ali. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.